Hello and welcome to Ditching Hourly. I'm Jonathan Stark. Today I'm joined by guest Jeff Scornavaca. Jeff is a business consultant who helps companies improve their contracting and offer development processes. He's worked with clients like Johnson & Johnson, Ocean Spray Cranberries, Reebok, and many more. Jeff's been value pricing enterprise clients like these for years, which is what we focus on in this episode. Without further ado, here's Jeff. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Jonathan, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
My pleasure. Can you start off by just letting people know who you are and what you do?
Sure. My name's Jeff Scornavaca. I'm the principal for Silver Lake Productions. We're predominantly a filmmaker development house, but lately we've gotten big time into, I think it's just some straight up, we've had some opportunities to get into straight up business consulting. We are about six or seven consultants strong right now.
Excellent. And are those W-2 employees or 1099?
Those are 1099s, actually. We're structured a bit different than most dev houses. I found that the going the 1099 route allowed us to attract a different kind of consultant, people with actually a little more life experience and just some ability to show a little more empathy, I think, to the client. And it's been a great route for us, so I have no regrets for it.
And how long have you been in business?
Silver Lake Productions has been around about 13 or 14 years now.
So what kinds of projects do you do? So I'm curious about the sort of type of project, size of project, type of customer, size of customer, that kind of thing, just to give people like a context scope-wise.
Sure. So we've sort of in our history, we've gotten involved in anything from helping companies like Ocean Spray Cranberries with all their labeling. There's basically two people involved in the design and production of every Ocean Spray branded label that you might ever see. We've gotten involved with Reebok Headwear. We were allowed them to expand their custom catalog from one catalog to 12 catalogs a year. That's all the that's all the hats you see. You know, for NHL, Major League Baseball, they were in the NFL for a time, pretty much all the collegiate sports. So it's really allowed them to expand their capabilities to go after some additional opportunities and markets. We've been involved in higher ed. We were with Middlebury College for a long time, helping them out. We've done some work for MIT, for Tufts University. We've gotten involved in small manufacturing to really help people analyze their business data better and help with their inventory and things. And about 11 years ago or so, we got involved with the medical device area. We had an opportunity to get involved with the contracting end of Johnson & Johnson's DePuy Synthes franchise. And so we've been down there, helping out with offer development and contract development. And it's been really great. There's been a lot of interesting problems to solve down there.
So, wow, that's an amazing client list. Congratulations.
Thanks.
I'm curious about the length of a typical project, the number of people that you would put on one. Are we talking about, 3-month things with a dev and a designer, or is it more like, 9 to 12 months with 3 or 4 people?
We, most of our projects are typically 9-month efforts, I'd say, at the most. I like to break, even if it's a bigger project, I like to break it down by steps we can declare victory on every once in a while. I think it's better for all concerned. We get product in front of the customer that can use immediately. And so we're a big fan of the sort of the agile method of product delivery. It allows, I think, people to become familiar enough with the client, but it also helps us just to not feel like we're like encumbered by any particular project for too long. So it seems that's been where the water level has risen for us, and it just seems like a really comfortable place for all concerned.
And how do you price a project of that size? Is it an hourly thing, a fixed price, value priced?
We usually try to do value pricing. We've gotten super into just walking them through the the process and of trying to uncover the value of the project and just see if it's a worthwhile project for them. And I think that, you know, we've been contacted several times and we've walked them through what I think they wanted to do. And we've gone, you know, I just don't think this is really a great project, you know, for us to be doing with you. There might be someone else that might want to engage you for this, but it just doesn't seem like for our expertise and for what we can bring to the table, that this might be a, you know, a good fit. And I think they've appreciated that when we've gone and been that candid with them. At the same time, you know, there's a lot of times that you are able to, if you're with a client for a long time, you're able to, gain a lot of capital knowledge about the workings of, you know, their compliance needs, about their procurement structure, about their IT infrastructure, about the way their business works, and all these things. So you can make yourself ever more valuable to your long term clients by kind of digging in a little bit and finding out more and be willing to learn about the challenges they face in the marketplace and their regulatory environment.
Sure, acting more as a partner than just a pair of hands to be instructed what to do.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, as an outsider to their organization, I think a lot of times we can spot opportunities for them and help them, guide them to some other choices that they may have not realized internally.
Mm. So now, did you always value price, or is that did you at one time do hourly and then switch over to that? How did that work?
You know, when we got involved with J&J, we billed by the hour, and then as a compliance concern, they actually, since we are basically a 1099 for them, they needed to move us to flat pricing. So they really wanted to move us to just giving here's a fixed price for the project, and there you go. And you know, at the time, this was right in the wake of the Microsoft case with the contractors versus employees kind of thing. And so they had all these criteria that made you look like ever closer to being an employee, right? Did you come in and sit in the same chair every day? Did you have a cube? Did you have a card? Did you have a phone? Do you bill by the hour? And so, you know, as they went by down these items, they were really caught on the bill by the hour thing. And so, you know, we moved by necessity. Like it was no grand plan of ours necessarily.
Yeah.
But as we did it, you know, we actually found that there were some things that we did that were incredibly valuable to them, and some things that were less valuable to them, and we were able to bill accordingly with it. You know, we had some. I think it's, you know, we've been largely pretty successful with it. We've certainly had some, you know, projects that I wish I had, you know, bid a little differently or estimated a little differently. But by and large, it's been very successful for us.
Excellent. So the projects that you're describing are, I would characterize as pretty, they're not huge, but pretty large, you know, 9-month project. I'm assuming we're talking, you know, 6-figure price tags. How do you keep the scope from, you know, going wild? Like what leads up to the project proposal, and what tactics do you use to prevent the scope from running wild and blowing your profitability?
You know, I think we had really, we've done a couple things. One of them is, I think in the proposal itself, we've really become focused more on outcomes than on you know, any sort of like technical details. I think if you were to look at a proposal that I might have done 10 years ago, it had all sorts of, you know, features listed in it that we were going to build and technical details about what the tables are going to look like. And I think that's largely a waste of time now. I think it really, if you can focus on, you know, identify the problem you were trying to solve and make sure that you're all focused on solving that problem. And so if something else comes up, you can ask yourself, well, how is that focused on solving the problem? And I think if the answer is, well, it's not really focused on solving the problem, but I want it to be this way anyway, I want it to be done anyway, you know, I think you have a much better chance to have a conversation of, well, why don't we set that aside for now? I understand your desire to have this, but let's finish through this. We'll put it on a list and we'll get it, you know, we'll evaluate it in the scope of everything else that comes up later on. And but let's make sure that we declare victory on what we've already decided to go upon. And a lot of times we'll go, and you know, by the time you when you get done with the project, yeah, they're not really that interested in, you know, in what they had talked about before, or it seemed whimsical, or you have a list for phase two, and some of these things, you know, at given time, you know, are still with merit, and so you want to get them done, so we work through another phase of the project.
Yeah, I've had the experience you just described is exactly what I've seen with projects of that size. If you have a litmus test to kind of validate these new, because new requests always come up in the middle of a project that's that long, because sure, things change, and you know, and somebody's hair's on fire, competitor did some move, you know, made some change in the marketplace, and right, or something happens, and people can freak out, lose their nerve, second guess themselves, and you know, they come running in with like, oh, we have to do this now, this is the most important thing. Mm. And very rarely, if you have that sort of goal, if they have the goal set in advance, it gives you a way to judge the validity of the suggestion. And it must have happened once to me, but I can't think of a time that an urgent request like that ever passed muster. I did exactly what you did, which is let's put this on a V2 list and revisit it. I love the phrase declare victory. Right. Once we, you know, I would say in order to protect the project, in the best interest of the project, we can't just be randomly adding things into it. We'll never finish.
Sure.
So let's finish and then reevaluate this. Exactly what you said. It's complete parallel.
And, you know, and sometimes things are going to change, you know, sometimes as you go through, you know, completely understanding, you know, your client's business, you know, there's plenty of opportunities already for other things to pop up, other discoveries you made, they might be opportunities, or they might be, you know, you may get digging into the discovery bit, part of the process and go, wow, what if you guys, you know, did it this way instead of that way? And like everyone goes, wow, that would be really great. No one's ever thought of that before. And then not that it would be necessarily our idea, but maybe in the course of everyone, you know, sitting around talking about whiteboarding out some ideas or brainstorming a little bit about an approach to a problem, you know, an idea will emerge. And at that point, you're like, wow, well, that's really gonna move this thing forward when you guys do it. That, you know, we should really consider doing that now. So it's not to dismiss change out of hand, but I think any sort of change needs to be evaluated, and you know, and just to see that, make sure that it wasn't just a strictly a, you know, just some passionate reaction to something.
Mm, yep, exactly. So is it fair to say that the vast majority of projects that you estimate and provide a value price for more or less stay on target?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I've had one or two that I didn't judge well. And I think that, you know, and I think part of that became, you know, just came from me missing a particular turn in the project that I didn't pay much attention to, but I chalked it up to lessons learned. But by and large, it's worked out really well for us.
Any desire to switch back to hourly billing for some new client?
Not really. Much as I love everyone is still submitting timesheets and, you know, sending me invoices every 1st and 15th of the month and tallying things up and just having the conversations about like what people did for this hour and why they charged for a phone call and why, you know, and all those things. I'll probably go back to that someday because I have such fond memories of it, but it's it's a delight, isn't it? So, but I, by and large, I really don't. It's really, I think, you know, I have no desire to move my business relationship with the clients back to an hourly thing. And I think at some point, you know, I would love to move, you know, my developers and other and consultants away from hourly billing to me and have them see if it's mm-hmm. acceptable to move to a sort of a fee for, you know, more of a fee-based operation.
Yeah, that's fascinating to sort of be a customer and provider of value price services. So it kind of, you know, it's better for everyone. So why wouldn't you want your suppliers to provide it to you?
You know, it's one of those things you need to, you know, start slowly. I think you need to, because by and large, you typically, you as the sort of the forward facing, customer facing, you know, business lead have a lot more typically estimation experience than your, maybe some of your devs. And so, you know, you need to allow them to dip their toe into the estimation experience so they can go and be successful if they're going to agree to do a piece of work for a price. And so, you know, you can do that in a lot of different ways. The first one is to, you know, have them, you know, try to, you know, try to estimate successfully and try to and see where they end up things and providing some feedback to them about what they did or didn't estimate well. But I, you know, when they have sort of drunk the Kool-Aid of doing that, it's worked out really well. I think that they've, you know, they're typically more focused on less exotic solutions to come up with things. They're focusing on solving the problem. You know, it's they feel happy that they can, you know, go and use you know, some tools to get these things done and buy some, you know, they're not focused on necessarily how long it's going to take. They're really more focused on, like, you know, when I'm done with this, wow, that'll be great. And, you know, to the point that, you know, doing this rewards their efficiency, right? So the better they get at coding, the more efficient they become, and the more they learn, you know, the language of what I expect, you know, the better they can come back to me and go, well, there we go. And, you know, it increases their potential, and frankly, it lowers my risk because I don't need to be, you know, I'm not open to the ever-ending flow of hours for the devs if I can do it.
Sure. Like I'm sure that, like most people who practice this, you couldn't care less how long it took them to do something.
That's right. That's right. And so, you know, to the degree that they understand, and a part of it is, you know, they need to understand their role in the process, right? So they need to, you know, they're sharing the risk, you know, at this point with you a little bit. And so you want to make sure that their first experience into this is in some sort of like mind-blowing, you know, risk that they're assuming, because it could be, because, you know, if it's a small risk that they're taking on, oh, okay, that wasn't so bad. You know, I think once they get away from having to track their hours, I think there's a lot of like, oh, that's much better. And, you know, and again, to have them understand their role in the process, you know, both in terms of estimation and just sort of how they fit to the larger picture.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the big takeaway here, and you've mentioned it twice or maybe even three times, is that it takes some maturity and some experience. And the smartest thing to do is start small, because, you know, you are taking on risk when you present a fixed price to someone, you know, whether it's value price or any other kind of fixed price. So if you're going to start doing that, and I believe that people should at least experiment with it to get a feel for, because it feels so different. It's almost like a different job. And it's risky. So taking a big, huge bet right out of the gate is almost certainly a bad idea. So,
sure.
Excellent advice. Baby steps.
And I think the, in my, you know, position in particular, you know, because we don't have W-2s, they're all 1099s. You know, I think that there's, you know, I tend to, with subs, there's a tendency to have it be a more fluid situation personnel-wise. So, you know, my goal is, you know, I never want to work with someone that I don't really like. And I try to keep, I'm trying to keep my folks as busy as they want to be and have a steady supply of work to keep them busy for me. Right. So, cause if I'm very sporadic or inconsistent with the work, you know, they may feel the need to go elsewhere with it. The other part of that is that, you know, I really try to, most of the times have it be work that they enjoy doing. You know, if someone doesn't like to be a forward facing consultant and would much rather work on, you know, some deeper technical things, you know, let's try to get you over doing that. If someone really likes to go and spend, you know, get in front of people and do the whole sort of discovery whiteboard process with the client and really loves that, let's get you doing that. I can't always do that, but I mean, that's really sort of, you know, to put people in the right spot that they can be successful and can enjoy doing things is really, is I think part of our success.
Interesting. I'm curious, I don't want to go down another whole rabbit hole, but just from a high level, how much time do you devote to calculating profitability of either individual developers or projects or clients as a whole?
I'm pretty confident that our projects are profitable. I certainly, you know, I like to first of all have a really happy client, and we're profitable enough, you know, basically on average, if you will, with our projects, so that given a choice between being profitable on a particular project or having a happy client, I will choose the happy client. Mm-hmm. And I want to be, if on average I'm not profitable, I would have to learn some different skills. but by and large, I'll always, if one particular project has, if I've, you know, basically underestimated it, or I've bid it badly, or if there's some aspect of it that I wasn't paying attention to, and it kind of got away from me, I want the project to be successful for the people who worked on it, my folks, and for the client in particular. So it's only happened once or twice, but I mean, when it comes down to that choice, I'll always make that choice of leaving a trail of happy clients.
Sure. So, you know, so we're talking like, what did you say at the beginning? 16 years, and once or twice you've had something get away from you, but the rest of the time it's all thumbs up.
It's been pretty good. There's been other times that we've gotten into, like, I think early on, that we've, you know, had projects, you know, just expand in scope, you know, 10 or 12 years ago. And I probably wasn't as good as managing that as I am now. I think now I call it immediately when I see it, just to let everyone know that, you know, the ramifications of their choice. It's better, I think, ultimately to learn, you know, you really need to learn some project management skills to be able to, and some people skills to be able to sit and say, you know, there's a nice way to tell someone no, or tell them, yes, I understand you want that, and let's take a look at that later, rather than no, I think that's a really stupid thing to do and you shouldn't be doing it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I think the main takeaway here is that when you're ready to start value pricing, or at least give it a shot, start small, because it does take practice. It's a mind shift, really. It's a different way of thinking. It's a different way of working. I'm a big fan. Obviously, you're a big fan. And I think other people will really enjoy it if they give it a try, but do it slowly with a low risk, smaller sort of project.
Yeah, and I would say absolutely start slowly and start small. And, you know, when you go in and try to estimate a project like this, you know, for a value-based project, try to get in there and find out why they want to do the project to begin with. What problems are they having? What opportunities are there? You know, if you end up doing this, you know, is it going to save them a ton of time? Is it going to save them a ton of effort? Are they going to be more compliant? What's that worth to them? And you know, the answers to those questions can guide you to, you know, how you're going to price the project, and, you know, whether it's a good client or not to start value-based pricing.
Yeah. Or even if it's, you know, I don't want to use the word ethical, but even if you're going to feel comfortable taking their money, like, you can't, if you don't know what they're trying to do, or if you don't have a reasonable level of confidence that they're going to benefit from writing this big check to you, then I feel like you haven't finished doing your homework. You know, it's like, I don't know. I just feel like the expert at the software piece which would be me or you or other developers, they need to kind of act like a doctor in this scenario where they are the expert and they don't just do what they're told, because that can be a gigantic waste of money. So on the one hand, I feel like a lot of times when people talk about value pricing, it sounds like it can come across to people who haven't tried it as some sort of like gouging or shakedown or something, you know, like, hey kid, how much you got? But in fact, it's the most client friendly approach that I've ever come across, because it forces you to have those conversations up front, and it doesn't always turn out that the project's a good fit. As you've said it a couple of times, you know, it's like, sometimes you're like, there's no good reason for you to pay me all the money that you would have to pay me to do this, because you're not going to get it back.
That's true. And you might as well find that out, you know,
before it's too
late. Immediately, right? And, you know, I think, you know, the other nature of our involvement with some big companies is, you know, we are not typically, you know, pitching and talking to the, you know, the ultimate person with the purse strings. We're talking to someone who's maybe a little more mid-level. And so we're going to have to, a lot of times we help them try to find out, you know, focus in really on what their need is, right? Because they may tell us that it's, our need is X and we need you to fix X, and then we can dig in a little bit and actually kind of find out it's Y. And so, you know, we need to assist them, you know, to come up with some sort of ROI document or some sort of, you know, other measure of success that you know, to help us all understand what the project's worth, but also for them to go and go and ask for the money, right? They're going to need to go and be the champion of this project, and they're going to need to go to their boss, and their boss is going to say, you know, why should I give you this money to go and do this project? You know, and for them to be able to make the case, about how much the project is worth the company. You know, if we spend $100,000, it's going to save us $2 million or $2 million. You know, it's a much easier way to convey the value to someone else if you've helped them do the homework of understanding what the value of the project is.
Mm, absolutely. Give them the tools to sell it up the chain.
Yeah. And you know, and in the process, it makes you more confident that what you're doing is providing value to the client, right? Because ideally, you know, the nature of trade is like, wow, you know, we exchange things and you're better off and I'm better off because of the trade. And, you know, then that's really what value-based pricing is all about.
Well said. Well, that's a perfect place to leave it. Where can people find out more about you, Jeff?
They can, Jeff at silverlakeproductions.com. If you want to hop onto our email list about working with big companies, you can go to workwithbigcompanies.com. And you can sign up to our email list there. And we send out emails once a week or so on various topics. But a lot of it has to do with sort of helping to understand how you can benefit by when you have the opportunity to go and work with some bigger companies.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure, Jonathan. Anytime.
That's it for today. I'm Jonathan Stark, and this is Ditching Hourly. Thanks for listening. The next time someone asks you for your hourly rate, this is what you should say. I don't have one. To learn what to say next, visit valuepricingbootcamp.com to sign up for my free email course. Again, that URL is valuepricingbootcamp.com.